Okay.
Reverend Edward Pinckney, the first pastor in the history of mankind to be sent to prison for quoting the Bible. I tell you, this has been a tremendous week once again. Every week seems to be going just the way it should be, should go. And also, this is day 68 of the illegal house arrest. I'm here to tell you that it is truly, truly a blessing. And I have my dear brother here on the line, Larry Pinckney. Larry, how are you doing today?
Well, greetings to you, my brother. I'm doing just fine. The struggle goes on.
Oh, that's a blessing all by itself. I tell you, it's been a tremendous war, and I tell you, we've been battling, and we've been doing all the things we need to do to make this thing right, not just for me, but for everybody.
Right.
And I tell you, it's been a challenge, Larry. I don't know what more to tell you other than that I'm prepared to whatever they dish out, I'm able to take, and I'm throwing it right back at them. So that's a tremendous blessing all by itself. And today we have on the line with us, Larry, a very, very dear friend of mine, General Baker from Detroit, Michigan. Mm-hmm. General Baker, are you there?
I'm right here, Reverend Pinckney. Hello, Larry. How you doing?
I'm doing great, brother. I'm so glad to hear your voice. You and I have a mutual friend, the late Glanton Dowdell.
Oh, fantastic, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow, we got to talk. We got to talk.
Yes, we do.
Yes, indeed.
Hey, General, you didn't know that there was such thing as Pinckney to Pinckney, do you?
Yeah, I heard Pinckney to Pinckney, man. And now since I know Larry knows Glanton,
yeah,
we really got to talk.
Right.
Yeah.
And Larry, let me tell you, that General is another one of my heroes. I tell you, he's a man who I love. And I respect more than anybody else around the city of Detroit. He know how I feel. See, I love this man. And I tell you, when I first met him, he told me this story. And I don't know how much of the story he's willing to tell today, but I don't care where he go with this story. I just love to hear it. And Larry, I want you to hear this story.
Me too.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
It's so tremendous. Well, General, let's start here.
Okay.
Let's first talk about when they wanted to induct you into the United States service.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Let's start there, General.
Okay.
And tell us the story from just talking to you get tired.
Okay. Well, listen. Let me tell you. This was during the Vietnam conflict. Matter of fact, the precise setting is 1965. I had been active around the local movements in the city of Detroit, Revolutionary Action Movement, Uhuru.
Drum.
Drum hadn't started then, but I had visited Cuba with a group of students in 64. And when I came back, I got a letter from the draft board from the local draft department down here at Fort Wayne. Asking me to come down and take a physical to check on my fitness for military service.
Wow.
It was at that point that I wrote them a letter called A Letter to the Draft Board where I explained to them essentially what my views on the war was, that I was not prepared to go to Vietnam and other parts of the world fighting my non-white brothers and sisters in the name, insidious name of freedom. But I went on to tell them that there are some wars that I'd be glad to fight in. And when the call is made to free South Africa, when the call is made to free Rhodesia, when the call is made to free Mississippi and South Carolina and free 12th Street here in Detroit, call for me, and I'll be the first one on hand. So I sent them that letter to the draft board, and their response to me was to about December of 1964. Their response was to send me a letter telling me I was a draft dodger. At that point, I went down to the draft board and told them that I wasn't dodging, I just wasn't going.
Uh-huh.
After I went back, earlier that year, about March, they sent me a letter for my induction telling me I was being drafted. And my draft date was September the 10th of 1965. So I had been active in the student movement at Wayne's campus. We'd done quite a few things. So what we done, we turned our whole little organization that was a little group called Uhuru into a new movement called the September the 10th Movement. That was the date of my induction into the service.
Wow.
So we used that date to create a new movement.
And you know what? Hey, I hate to interrupt you, but that's my sister's birthday, September the 10th.
Ain't that something, man?
Yeah.
That date is historic.
That's a story all by itself.
You know what I'm doing? I'm sitting here looking at police files and state police reports from that date.
Uh-huh.
You know, the stuff that they collected on us for that date.
Wow.
But what we done, we built a movement, basically one around destroying the draft. And we had rallies all over the city at the Brewster and Jeffries Projects down on 12th Street and Pingree. We went to all the high schools, college campuses, and passed out literature at all the plants, building a massive movement to confront the U.S. rulers at the draft board on September the 10th. Now, listen, we had got quite a bit of momentum around this issue of destroying the draft because we were really after destroying the draft itself.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of things happened in the process of this thing that helped move that movement along, and I think they were really important and significant. The most important thing that happened in the course of that movement was the Watts Rebellion that took place in August of 1965.
Okay, that's in L.A.
That's right. When the Watts mm-hmm. Rebellion took place, the whole movement for black power and black freedom moved up a big notch, you know, because mm-hmm. Watts was the biggest, you know, rebellion at that time in history. And mm-hmm. it took place kind of in a timely fashion for us. Meanwhile, as we campaigned around the city, one day the police arrested us. We were posting signs all over the city saying destroy the draft.
Okay.
And they arrested us. And when they were taking us down to the police station, one of the brothers in the car asked them, what are we arresting for? Or being arrested for, and they hollered criminal anarchy, rebellion against the government.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, wow. So, okay, they took us on down to jail and said,
wow.
I think what happened was essentially they tipped their hand by mm-hmm. telling us that. They ended up holding us on illegal posting because that's all we were doing was posting stuff without legality. We had
uh-huh.
we had a big old roaster full of oatmeal and pet milk. You know, that stuff is real good for posting.
Yeah,
and we were posting signs all over the place, and that's really all they had on us.
Uh-huh.
But that
was posting signs without a permit, ain't it?
Oh yeah, we didn't have no permit. But
uh-huh.
So what happened was that they had tipped their hand talking about criminal anarchy.
Uh-huh.
We had got reports that they had planned to arrest most of the people that came down to the demonstration on September the 10th at Fort Wayne, and they were going to play up new names in the process. So by finding that out, we went down and talked to some attorneys and tried to figure out legally what constituted criminal anarchy.
Uh-huh.
And we did some things. You know, we found out where federal property ended and the city property began right down there at the Fort Wayne Induction Center. And we prepared ourselves to go on down. We decided that what we would do strategically, we put out a leaflet about 4 days before September the 10th. And in that leaflet, we put it in a place where we knew it would get in the police's hands. And in that leaflet, we told people in the streets that essentially that we had found out that the city fathers planned to attack the leaders of the September the 10th movement. They were going to attack us en masse. And because of that, we were asking our brothers and sisters to stay back in standby positions in the neighborhoods.
Wow.
You know, and stay back and hold, you know, as a second line of defense, and ended it by saying, "Remember Los Angeles."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
yeah,
so
you tell me. I love that. Hey, Larry. Hey, I mean, this is just an incredible story, and it gets better.
Yeah. Okay. So we went on down. I went on down to the induction office that morning. You know, our strategy was to go in and go all the way to the. To where you swear in at, because I wanted to make sure I passed the physical. I didn't want them to come up claiming I was a lame anyway.
Uh-huh.
So I went through the physical process and got through all of that. And if it came time to swear in, I told him, well, you better call the police because I'm not swearing in this damn army.
Uh-oh.
You know, so at that point, they sent me in the back to Captain Cox's office, and they sit down.
What year was that, brother?
This was September the 10th, 1965.
Okay, okay.
Okay, and they told me, asked me what my views were. I explained it to them. I told them I wrote you the letter. I have not changed my mind. I'm more firm now than I was then. Mm-hmm. So they told me they were going to send me on home and declare me a security risk. So I left and went outside, and we had our little demonstration set up for about 4 o'clock that evening. We had called for 50,000 angry people to show up at the induction center, and I think when we counted heads at the end, we had about 9. Mm-hmm. It was about 9 of us. We picketed for about an hour and a half and went on home. Now, listen, I got in front of me, Brother Pickney, I got the Michigan State Police Operations Office.
Uh-huh.
And it's called Demonstration Set for Fort Wayne, Michigan, on September the 10th, 1965.
Wow.
And they go through all these details, man. They had canceled all the leaves at the military base on that day. They had sent for a special group of riot rangers from Virginia and had them stationed at the Selfridge Air Force Base. The name of the operation was supposed to be Operation Steve Hill. And they were prepared to descend on anybody that came. They also said in this that informant advised that RAM, the Revolutionary Action Movement, have in their possession a 37-millimeter anti-tank gun with ammunition, and they also have in their possession numerous automatic small arms.
Wow.
But I got this report sometime. I'd like to show it to you, but it's straight out of the police files. But that's what happened that day. We called for 57, and we got 9.
Wow.
But the 9 was effective.
Right. Absolutely. All you need is 3 or 4.
They didn't come after me no more on that draft, on that refusal for draft.
Okay.
Now, I want to let you know now, that was before Muhammad Ali's refusal.
Right.
His refusal took place in 66.
Uh-huh.
There's a couple of things. It was most of the brothers and sisters at that time were taking two alternatives. One, what we call them the left, they were just splitting and going underground or going into Canada.
Mm-hmm.
The other one we call the right wing kind of guys, they were putting on a backward collar and claiming they was conscientious objectors.
Okay.
We decided to go down the middle. We're not running, damn it. And we do believe in fighting. It's just not this war. So we went down that route directly, and that was the results of it, Reverend Pickney, Brother Pickney's. And that was our experience there. I got some pictures and things in front of me of the event itself that the police took. Because, you know, back in those days, we didn't have no cameras, man. I mean, if the police files weren't so tight, we wouldn't even have a record of the event.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah,
how did you manage to get those files?
Well, you know, back in the 70s, Pickney, when they first disclosed the fact that they had these police files, and that was an important struggle itself because all of us knew that they had police files. You know, I used to get up in the morning and get ready to go to work, man. One police car would be in front of me, one in back. I used to go up and signify with them. I told them, man, why don't I just ride with you?
Yeah,
save you some gas money.
Uh-huh.
You know, I won't do a number going out there to Dodge Main making cars all day and coming home, you know. Yes, sir.
I want to ask you, for the sake of our audience, because, you know, your history is extremely important, and I want you, if you will, to not just your history, but your present reality too. But I want you to draw some, and I'm going to name some things that I ask you to elaborate on yourself.
Okay.
One,
sure.
I really do want you to talk a bit about the League of Revolutionary Black Workers.
Yes, sir.
About Drum and about the Black Radical newspaper, the Inner City Voice, that you are the founders of.
Definitely.
So take your time, get there wherever you want, but draw those, you know, draw it all together for our audience.
Okay, I sure will. I want to tell you that was 1965. Now, in 1967, you know, which was the, as far as I'm concerned, is the highlight of the history of Detroit was that 1967 rebellion that took place. And I want to let you know that there was a little rebellion in Detroit in 1966. It's usually called the Kerseville Street Incident.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was that the police forces at that time was able to crush that little rebellion. That rebellion started like all of them did, you know. Brother standing on the street corner, the police riding by harassing them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, each one of those rebellions, if you look at them all over the country, started for the same reason. People sick and tired of this police harassment.
And always right. seemed like the police department looked like, you know, they don't want to take credit for it, but they are the ones who normally start these things.
That's right. That's right. They rode by the corner over on Kerseville and mm-hmm. hollered out, "Go home." The brothers responded, "Hell, you go home. We ain't home."
Right.
You know, then the response be, "Well, don't be here when we get back." And they say, "Well, hurry up. Matter of fact, don't leave." So the police jump out and the battle starts. You know, and almost all of those incidents took place the same way. Well, they had relative success in squashing that rebellion in 1966. I got arrested along. Me and Glenn Dowdell got arrested together in that one. For
yep.
carrying concealed weapons in an automobile.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the thing that kind of squashed that rebellion, it rained like hell the next four nights. Matter of fact, we were laying up in the county jail getting rained on. It was the rain was so hard, and that pretty much squashed that rebellion. But it kind of set the police department up because they thought that their little police force could handle anything that might happen in the city. So by 1967, the next year, they could not handle the 12th Street outbreak.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the rebellion broke in 1967, and it was some differences, some things that were different in the Detroit rebellion than most of the others that I like to highlight sometime. First of all, during the Detroit rebellion, we had an assassination that took place inside of the rebellion, where these mm-hmm. police officers assassinated these three young brothers down at what's called the Algiers Motel.
Mm. Right, right.
And matter of fact, there's a book written by John Hershey called Algiers Motel Incident, and you can't find that no place in Detroit public schools.
Wow.
They not only
Would
that.
Would you repeat that, brother, because it's a tremendously important book. I've read it many times.
Yeah.
Just repeat it.
Yeah, it's called the Algiers Motel Incident, and
mm-hmm.
it's the story of this assassination of these three young black guys at the Algiers Motel in the city of Detroit. And it took place in the midst of the rebellion. The police were brought to trial and never charged and went scot-free.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, now the Algiers Motel has been wiped off the map. They tore it down about 20 years ago, and they got a gated street right there at Virginia Park of Woodward where it used to stand. They've obliterated that piece of history.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that made the Detroit Rebellion so different at that time is that they arrested so many people. They arrested 5,000 of us.
Is that right?
Yeah, I spent 15 days in Ionia State Penitentiary for violation of curfew. Me and Glenn both did.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
They arrested so many people, they had to arrest people on Belle Isle. Matter of fact, they call it Belcatraz.
Uh-huh.
They used Belle Isle, our famous island that we go picnic on, and stuck people out there on the island, and they had to stay on the island until they went to court date. And the third thing was the integrated nature of the Detroit Rebellion. It was blacks and whites were looting and rioting together in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, when I got to Ionia State Penitentiary, I had two white boys on my cell block that was arrested for sniping.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it was the integrated nature of that rebellion that's important to know. And matter of fact, whatever account you read on the Detroit Rebellion, everybody says the same thing. Coleman Young's book, in his history, he talks about the integrated nature of the rebellion and everything like that. So it's
mm-hmm.
important. But it was one thing that was so important for us, Brother Pickney's, that we learned from that rebellion, and that was when the Army came in, when the 82nd Airborne and the state troopers come in, and they established curfew. If you got sick, you couldn't go to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
If you got hungry, you couldn't go get no food.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had a badge from Chrysler, Ford, or General Motors, you could get through the police lines, the state trooper lines, the National Guard lines, and the Army lines to take your black butt to work.
Wow.
Let me interject right here. Listen to what this brother just said.
Yeah.
Okay, listen to what this brother said.
Okay.
All my brothers and sisters nationally and particularly in Benton Harbor. He talked about the power of corporations.
He talked about
Whirlpool.
That's right.
And you know one thing? You would never imagine that if you didn't know. If you had not told me that, you know, my mind couldn't even compute that. You have an uprising, but yet and still, all you need is a badge from one of the automakers, and you're able to do whatever you want.
That's right. That's right.
Man.
So we learned a lesson from that. If you had a badge from any of the big three, you can get through all the police lines and go to work.
Mm-hmm.
A lesson we learned out of that was the only place that black people had any value in this society was at the point of production.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we turn our work towards organizing in the factory. And that's why we started and began the process that led to DRUM and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, because we figured at the point of production.
Tell the audience what DRUM is, brother, because I know.
Okay, all right. All right, okay, let me tell you. DRUM stood for the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement.
Okay.
And it was called the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement because the movement was born at the Dodge plant, the plant that we call Dodge, Maine, that we made the Dodge cars at. And we had a significant workforce at that plant. It was at that time we had 10,000 employees at the Dodge, Maine plant. And we made all the Dodges and the Plymouth Barracudas. The workforce at that time was, I hired in 1964 at that Dodge Maine plant. Matter of fact, when I hired in, I hired in along with 4,000 other people. They hired 4,000 at once because they put a whole new shift on. So the plant had become majority black. And we still had the old line, white Polish leadership in the plant, management in the plant, foreman in the plant, the same old union structure that existed there before we got there. So we just had a big clash. But, you know, from 1964 to 68, we had a couple of strikes, but nothing real significant began to happen until after the Detroit Rebellion. See, the Detroit Rebellion changed people. The people that went into that rebellion were not the same people that came out.
Okay.
That's right.
Brothers, I'm going to tell you, I used to talk to guys all the time about police brutality.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how our people are. I'm talking to one guy. He said, man, I ain't got no problems with the police. They ain't never done nothing to me. They whooped my brother's ass, but they ain't never whooped mine.
hey, General, they ain't messing with me. They messing with my brother.
Right. So you had that kind of attitude. But, man, after that rebellion, everybody hated the police. They shot up so many rounds of ammunition in this city. You know, they brought in these army personnel carriers with 50 caliber machine guns on the front. And then they shot up everything in this city. In another book called Violence in the Motor City by a guy named Sidney Fine, that does a study of Detroit Rebellion, talks about almost 200,000 rounds of ammunition that was shot by the National Guard and state troopers and police, compared to about a 200 and some rounds that was shot by the 82nd Airborne.
Right.
You know, which had all them brothers in it and knew how to handle crowds and things. But but everybody hated the police. Matter of fact, we picked up those empty 50 caliber machine gun shells off the ground and put rawhide through them and wore them as necklaces as a symbol of the rebellion.
Wow.
Right. So badge of honor.
Yeah. So when we went back to work, let me tell you, I did 15 days in Ionia State Penitentiary, and my cell block looked like the assembly line.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I had so many guys off the assembly line I worked in that thing that when I got back to work, they couldn't run production at full speed yet because they had too many workers still locked up in jail.
Mm-hmm.
Just to show you who was in the rebellion. And I like to talk about that because people always tell me, always the brothers on the streets and blah, blah, blah. I tell you, I had a friend of mine who was a booster. You know, he was good for about 3 soups a day out of Hudson's.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got thrown in the lockup that night, looked like about 10 o'clock that night, they threw him in the garage with me. They had us, at first they had so many people arrested, they just threw us in the garage, man, and put the door down on each side, put one of the 50 caliber machine guns on the outside, told you if you run, you're getting shot.
Because
they didn't have enough room in the cells and stuff. But I was talking to him. I said, what happened? He said, listen, he said, look, I was out there when this thing started that morning. And I saw these people breaking in and stealing stuff. And he said, he's looking at him, he said, that's just not the way to steal. You don't steal like that.
You know? I love it. I love
it. He told himself, he said, they're going to get busted because they don't know what the hell they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
He said he messed around there all day long. Said about 4 o'clock that evening, he finally got up enough nerve. The first time he went in the store, he come out with a bag of potato chips and a pop. But then he said later on when he cut loose and started stealing everything and won't nail down and got busted. But I tell that little story because I want people to know who was in the rebellion and who wasn't, you know.
Right.
Normally the
right.
guys on the street that was doing a lot of stealing couldn't get ready for it. They weren't prepared.
Mm-hmm.
But regular working people, man, jumped in it, you know, set up all kind of schemes to take everything. You know, they had those convertible cars running down the street, man, stop at the shoe store. The two guys in the back jump out, come out with armloads of shoes, then go to the clothing store, then go down the street to some TV. Man, they was loading up stuff, man. They really got organized.
Wow.
But in the looting process. But I wanted to tell you that because I think it's relatively important to know the character of the rebellion and the people that was upset about it. I did 15 days when I finally got back and production started pretty much up about the time we got maybe in the middle of August, the end of September, when the workforce got back. You know, it was just a different place, man. Everybody came back with a tall afro and these 50 caliber machine gun bullets hanging around your neck, man. And these foremen were scared to death. And they better been, too, because people won't take it no shit no more.
Oh, that's just a beautiful saying.
Yeah, and that's the conditions that's frying drums. So we began, you know, they started speeding the line up on us, and we went on strike because they was running the line so fast, nobody could keep up, and we all went out on strike on a Thursday night on lunchtime on afternoon shift. And a bunch of white workers led the way on that strike. And when we came back off of lunch, we made sure that nobody go back in the plant. And they had to shut down. And the little union leadership got on their horse and ran to Atlantic City to a convention they was having. So you couldn't find them, and the strike went on for about 4 days.
To tell me about the union. Was the union strong during those days?
The union was strong, but not for us. Walter Reuther, who was head of the UAW, is head and shoulders above this fool we got today called Ron Gettelfinger.
Right.
But remember now, Reuther marched in the street with Martin Luther King. I was out there with him in '63.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed up at all the right places on the social front, but he wouldn't do a damn thing about all that discrimination inside the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the difference. And that's why we had to take on the fight against the union and the company trying to straighten out all of the discrimination.
Wow.
You know, you hire in with a white boy, he end up your foreman or your inspector or driving a high-low or something, and you down in the foundry sweating like a mule, man, with a sludge hammer on the knockout line, you know, for the blocks coming down the foundry line. You know, and that's the way it was. You could never get in skilled trades, could never upgrade to nothing. And those are the kind of conditions that we were battling, you know?
Wow. Well, you know, General, I know how you are, you know.
Yeah.
And I know that you wouldn't. Hey, Larry, I know that you had to be right in the middle of whatever shutdown that y'all had there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I knew it was going to fire me because I'm the loudest.
Yeah.
And you know, just like you and any other crowd, you got to get the loudest one first.
Absolutely.
You know, so I knew they was coming after me.
Yeah.
But it's during those days when you got a wildcat strike, when we actually got to meet people from the other side of the plant. You know, it was 10,000 people in there, a lot of people you just didn't know.
Right.
But during a wildcat strike, what's different is you come every day because you really don't know whether you're going to strike or not, right?
Mm.
So you come in and mill around, and people's attitude gets to change and say, oh, we ain't going in today. So people hang out. And it's in those periods where we hung out like that that the core people that became the leadership of Drum finally met one another. We met some people from the other side of the plant, from the seventh floor, you know, all over. So we had a little crew that finally met one another. And one of the things that became clear as we talked to these brothers from the other side of the plant, they didn't know why we had walked out or what the strike was about. Because
mm-hmm.
by the time the word gets to them, the story done changed 15 times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was under those conditions that we decided that what we had to do was to organize ourselves around a little newsletter that would unite everybody in the plant on the same issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what gave birth to DRUM as a little newsletter entity that would come out once a week, and we'd write all the stories of the things that was taking place in the plant, and we could unite people around the issues. And that's what became the background for that. Now, Brother Pinckney was asking earlier about the Inner City Voice newspaper. The Inner City Voice newspaper grew up right after the rebellion in Detroit. So the Inner City Voice newspaper had already started, and I was working on the staff there, and we had resources. Newspaper was a little inner city newspaper that came out once a month, and we were the voice of the revolutionary movement in Detroit.
Mm.
But we had equipment. We had typesetting equipment and printing equipment that we used to print the paper, and so we were able to take that same printing equipment and put out a little newsletter for the plants. And so we had developed skills and things in printing and agitating that helped us, because if it had not been for that, we wouldn't have been able to press ahead on the newsletters and stuff without those resources.
Wow. Wow.
So then that grew. You know what happened after about 9 weeks of publication of this paper, you know, people start coming into it, say, well, y'all talking stuff, what you gonna do? You know? So we decided we better develop an action plan. We were gonna have a little demonstration at the plant, go down to UAW headquarters on Jefferson and have a demonstration. Go to Chrysler headquarters, have a demonstration, and then if none of all that worked, then we'd strike the plant. Well, what happened was we went to the meeting of the executive board, and one of the brothers got excited and called for a strike the next morning. So we jumped over about two or three different tactics and called for the strike, and everybody split. So we had to go out and strike that plant the next morning. We're not quite sure if people was going to stick with us or not, because mm-hmm. we hadn't had enough time to test the water. But we had a little coffee shop where people came and played conga drums all night. So we took the drummers out the next morning and a bunch of youth, and we had picket signs, and we set up picket lines around the plant. And my goodness, in a half hour's time, we had 3,000 black workers on the street, man, didn't know what to do with them.
Wow.
You know, because, you know, oftentimes when you call for action, you don't know whether you're going to be successful or not.
Right.
And once they came out, now we stuck, because the state troopers had lined the top of the building with high-powered rifles. The Hamtramck Police Department and Detroit Police Department had us in pincher movements coming from each side. And the brothers and sisters was out there breaking off beer bottles, you know, and stuff while we go get ready to fight.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to organize them in the carpools and take half of them down to the union headquarters and half of them down to the corporate headquarters and have demonstrations and pickets. So we're able to divert that confrontation that we're confronted with right there at the point. But that's right.
While still being effective. Very effective.
Very effective. The plant was shut down. The strike went on for 5 days. And Chrysler Corporation declared the strike to be extra legal instead of illegal, because they hadn't seen one like this before. See, we only asked black workers to strike. We didn't ask the white workers to strike. We asked the black workers to strike because we wanted to prove that blacks alone could shut down this facility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what happened was after that, that movement just spread. You know, people came from all other kind of plants saying, listen, we want a drum movement over here. We want a drum movement over there. Because everybody was faced with the same kind of rugged conditions inside the shop. So the movement just began to blossom and grow. So
Brother
kind
Baker,
of the,
let me...
Yes.
Let me ask you something. I'm sorry. Let me ask
sure.
you something.
Sure. Uh-huh.
Since we're so limited in our time, and I can see this is powerful.
Okay.
I would like for you, for our audience, to draw a parallel
uh-huh.
of the incredible history that you just described
okay.
in the nutshell, even though I'm sure there are a million
uh-huh.
details that
yeah.
were left
okay.
out.
Okay.
But would you draw a parallel of
uh-huh.
those times and the present? Particularly as it relates in this case, to Reverend Pinckney, Benton Harbor, and the whole community of Benton Harbor, Michigan?
I certainly will. First of all, let me say that in the middle of the 60s, like I had said, the conditions that led to the rebellion had led to an uprising of the population of Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
So people were prepared and organized and beginning to resist and fight back on all fronts.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't exist today.
Mm-hmm.
Inside the shops, we had people that were inside the shops that was upset at the conditions they were confronted with, and they were prepared to fight. On the economic front, this was a period of expansion. You know, the plants were expanding, not contracting like they are today.
Mm-hmm.
That also helped because every other week they were coming out saying that we're going to close the Dodge main plant and move it. Well, hell, we didn't care. We were prepared to fight for what we had inside the shop. Let me say this, the other thing, that quite a bit of unity had developed during the two rebellions in 66 and 67 in the city of Detroit, and people were showing real concern with each other, not only on the economic front in the plants, but on the front against police brutality. People had got tired of it, and they weren't prepared to take it any longer. Now, they didn't get there all of a sudden. It took them a while to develop that kind of consciousness where they just had got fed up and said it's not going to go this way anymore. I think, Reverend Pinckney, that's the kind of experiences you had with the Benton Harbor Rebellion a few years back.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, when people just get sick of this thing.
See, one of the things, too, that, you know, people just have to get sick and tired of being sick.
And
that's why, it's so important for you to be on our show today.
Right.
I know Larry and myself, we're very, very happy to have a guy like you, especially a person, a true hero.
Yeah, okay. Right.
You know, and you all that, you know it.
Well, listen, I'm so proud to be on here because, like I told you before, I didn't think, for a whole lot of reasons, I didn't think I was going to live through all of this. And since I did, I'm prepared to tell this story wherever I can,
mm-hmm.
as wide and far as I can, for people to be able to draw lessons from these experiences.
Yeah.
Because I don't think some of us were supposed to make it through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, but anyway, those are the kind of conditions that existed at that point that don't exist today. But, Larry, let me tell you this. I had, Edward, let me tell you, I always cherish my experience because I had a chance to see the people rise up in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a theoretical question to
mm-hmm.
me. I realize that people take so much stuff and they get to a breaking point and then they rise up.
Right.
What happens to most of us is that the people that's in a position to lead these things, being got tired and quit by the time the folks rise up. So when they rise up, ain't no leadership there.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Our people don't want to be patient enough.
Mm.
They turn on the masses of people talking about, oh, ain't nobody going to do nothing. No, people will do something, man. And we just be patient and persistent enough.
Hey, Jerome, one thing I learned is that everybody uh-huh. wants to be a leader.
Yeah.
See, I think that's one of our pitfalls there. Everybody
right.
wants to
yeah.
be a leader.
Yeah.
See, I myself, I don't mind stepping back and letting somebody else take control.
Yeah, I know.
You see,
and
personally, if you really ask me, I'd rather see somebody else. If they're going to do it, if they're not going to do it, I'm going to have to roll over on them.
Well, you know what? All real leaders feel that way.
Because
mm-hmm. I always felt that way, too, man. I'd rather have somebody else do this. But, like they say, who's going to do it? Nobody but you.
That's right.
You know, so it's on us, man, to try to provide that. But I just think it's important to know that people do rise up. You know, they don't lie down as docile lambs forever.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
And we have to be prepared to lead them when they rise.
Mm. Let me ask you another question right fast. See,
uh-huh.
what we did lately, we brought the NAACP into and we're using it more as a recruiting tool more than anything else.
Good.
And believe me, it's worked.
I know. Okay.
it has worked so well that it's almost scary.
I got you. Okay.
I'm instead of requesting maybe before I was saying we want 100 people to join.
Yeah, okay.
We got 100 people.
Yeah.
Then I said I want 200. We got 200. Now I'm saying I want 1,000.
I got you. Okay.
You see?
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
So and people are dying to join this. I know you and Larry. See, I know you and Larry. Y'all think pretty much the same way I do.
Yeah, that's fantastic, man.
And I have noticed something, and now. People who have never called me before in their life are calling me
and
want to join our band.
That's right. That's fantastic.
See, one of the things, we was at a standstill for a little while.
I got you. Okay. Uh-huh.
We couldn't get people moving. Everybody, especially since I was arrested.
That's
and,
right.
And
that's
everybody
right.
got scared. They didn't want to hang
that's
out
right.
with me.
That's right. That's
now,
right.
Now, all of a sudden, everybody want to hang out with me.
That's right. That's right.
You
that's
see?
Right.
I can't find nobody who don't want to do it now.
Hey, that's on the heels of a tremendous victory you had, man.
That's a tremendous victory, man, to
beat back the whole reactionary legal system in the western part of the state.
Yeah,
man, that was fantastic to do that.
Especially here in this area.
Yeah.
They still burning crosses up here.
I know, man. So.
And Larry, I know how you feel about stuff like this, because I talk to you all the time too.
Yeah.
This is something that I can see where things could really come to a boiling point and things really start happening.
Yeah, right.
But I tell you, I got Gabriel on the line,
okay.
And I think he want to ask you a question.
Okay, all right, sure.
All right, hold up 1 second.
Okay.
Gabriel, are you there? Gabriel.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Okay.
Okay,
listen, I got Gerald on the line. Did you want to ask him a question or two?
Yeah, how you doing, brother?
Alhamdulillah, excellent, brother. How's everything going?
Hey, man, we in a struggle. We're struggling along.
Hey, look here.
Yeah.
Hey, that's the name of the game.
It sure is. It sure is.
That's the name of the game. Hey, it's so good to hear your scenario of the Sixers, because that was exactly how it was.
Yeah, I'm telling you. Yeah. I'm telling you, brother. We got to bring our young people around and let them learn them lessons, you know?
Absolutely. You know, and that's one of the things I'm doing with the NAACP, too.
Fantastic.
My goal is to bring the young folks in.
Yes, fantastic.
And what we're going to do, and General Gabriel, Larry, my goal is to get these young folks so we can pass the torch to them.
Yeah, okay.
But we got to train them.
Yes, we sure do.
If we don't train them, we're heading up the wrong path.
That's fine.
There is no movement on planet Earth that has been without the young people.
That's
and
right.
The quasi-intellectuals, or I should say those of the scholastic level.
Yeah, right, right, okay.
So, you know, the beauty of this whole thing, that we're all on the same page here.
That's right, it sure is.
You know, we got some of the greatest people, matter of fact, on this show today that's probably been on any show in a long period of time.
That's great, that's great.
We've all been burned. We know.
Yeah. Hey, Brother Larry.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm really interested in knowing how what was your acquaintance with Brother Glenn Dowdell.
Larry, tell him about it.
I'll be very brief. I assume you know that I was a section leader in the Black Panther Party.
I see. Okay. All right. Okay.
And I met Glanton. Going through Detroit. I was also Minister of Interior for the RNA, for the Republic of New Africa.
Okay, fantastic. Okay.
But how I really got to know Brother Glanton was when he was in exile, I also was in political exile in Stockholm, Sweden.
We
became extremely close.
Fantastic.
And you know, so much of what you were saying, not only had I read, but I had been honored and privileged to have sat down with Glanton and exchanged, as we would say, war stories.
Okay, all right.
Because, you know, my background as an organizer in the party was primarily in California. So when Glanton and I hooked up, it was like a godsend.
Oh, fantastic, Larry. Fantastic. Yeah. I got some people that's interested in trying to put together Glenn's biography.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's got to be done because,
as we
were all saying, is that patience is a revolutionary virtue.
I'm telling you.
And in addition to that patience, we must, as Reverend Pinckney said, we must pass the torch to our youth. And one of the ways we must do it is they must see that they have heroes and sheroes around them.
Please
put it together.
Okay, all right. We certainly will.
Matter of fact, it don't get any better than that. It doesn't get any better than that. I tell you, this has been so tremendous, and I tell you, I'm going to be listening to this show over and over and over again myself because I'm just that excited. I got my brother there, Larry Pinckney. I got my General Baker there. I got Gabriel there. I got everybody right there who we can openly communicate with. I mean, true heroes.
Yeah,
true heroes.
Right.
True warriors. True soldiers.
I'm telling you,
it don't get any better than this.
I tell you,
I am truly, truly excited.
That's fantastic, Reverend Pinckney.
I'm telling you, and you know, I'm coming from you from my heart.
I'm just flattered to be in the
company of you fellas.
Hey, and likewise, man.
Right back there, bro.
You feel out of it. Yeah.
Man, I don't even know what to tell you, you know.
Okay.
We got so many callers today. I mean, the whole thing is just filled up.
Okay, that's fantastic.
We'll let you do your thing then, brother.
Well, we brought General on to tell this story, and you had another story that I really loved in reference to the Union and these guys.
I know, man. It's so many different stories.
Right.
We'll get to those in time.
Yeah, well, good. It's just an honor.
I tell you.
Hey, Libby, is you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Did you have a question for General Baker?
Well, I was going to say two things.
Okay.
First of all, that this is some of the most important radio I have ever heard, and all of these stories need to stay alive, and everybody needs to know them.
Okay.
And I think what you're all doing is so very important. And the stories are not only important, but interesting.
Yeah, thank you.
The other thing I was going to do is just remind the listeners and everyone that Reverend Pinckney is still under unconstitutional and illegal house arrest.
That's right.
Being enforced by Berrien County, Michigan Courthouse, and this would be day 60-something.
Okay.
68.
Day 68.
Day 68.
Okay, all right.
And so we have a higher court,
okay.
The State Appeals Court, which basically freed Reverend Pinckney, and yet still the lower court is keeping him on house arrest, which is absolutely unbelievable, and I don't get it. I don't know if you have time for the reading of a very interesting take on Reverend Pinckney's situation from Alternet.
I have it
in front of me, and it's short. Maybe I should start it, and you can just stop me.
Okay, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll take it from there.
Fantastic.
Hey, General, because it's your show today, so
No. It's our show.
It's our show. Okay, I like your attitude already.
Yeah.
See, that's why you're a general.
You're right.
You see, you're a general, and I'm a lieutenant.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, this is a story from Alternet, which is an online sort of, publication.
Okay.
It actually is entitled How Yawning Got One Court Spectator 6 Months in the Slammer and Another and Other Disturbing Acts of Judicial Tyranny. And one of them is Reverend Pinckney's story, and his is number 7 in the stories. And it's entitled Preacher Casts Demons Upon Judge Gets 3 to 10 Years. In a somewhat wackier example of judicial overreach involving the First Amendment, Edward Pinckney, a Baptist minister, was sentenced to 3 to 10 years for publishing an article in which he called a Michigan judge racist, corrupt, and dumb, while also damning him to eternal hellfire. Convicted in 2005 of election violations. Now, my comment there would be, of course, that was being framed. Okay,
sure,
back to the article. Pinckney was given a highly unorthodox probation order by Judge Alfred Butzbaugh, who banned him from engaging in any assaultive, abusive, defamatory, demeaning, harassing, violent, threatening, or intimidating behavior, including the use through any electronic or print media under his care, custody, or control of the mail, email, or internet. Now, in Turley's opinion, it is unbelievable, quote, that any prosecutor or judge would include such a blatantly unconstitutional provision in an order, unquote. And, quote, a first-year law student would recognize the provision as an obvious violation of the First Amendment, unquote. In defiance of the order, in 2007, Pinckney published an article in which he declared, Judge Butzbaugh, it shall come to pass, if thou continue not to hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God to observe to do all that is right, which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon you and your family. Curses shall be in the city of St. Joseph, and cursed shalt thou be in the field. Cursed shall come upon you and your family and overtake thee. Now, he was paraphrasing the Bible there.
Sure.
In March 2008, a different judge found that Pinckney had violated the conditions of his probation, determining that his statements amounted to a, quote, true threat, unquote, against Butzbaugh. He sentenced him to 3 to 10 years. This is just all in that good old Berrien County courthouse, but that's the article. According to MichiganMessenger.com, quote, Pinckney served a year of his sentence before the ACLU of Michigan successfully argued that he'd be released pending an appeal of his probation violation, unquote. Last month, an appeals court panel, quote, upheld Pinckney's conviction on the election-related charges, but struck down the revocation of his probation and the 3 to 10 year sentence imposed by Judge Wiley. Actually, I think that was done in May, unquote. Pinckney, and this is the last couple sentences, Pinckney called it a, quote, major victory, unquote. The ACLU of Michigan praised the decision and said, to our knowledge, this case marks the first time in modern history that a preacher has been thrown in prison for predicting what God might do, unquote, and that's the end of the article. So the thing that I'm struggling with here is, how is it possible, because I am not a legal expert, that this lower court, a county court, can supersede a decision made by a state court and keep this preacher on tether in his house?
Well, here's the problem. They do what they want to do down here because people are afraid to move. People are afraid to open their mouth. This is what I've been fighting for years.
Yeah.
Because we understand the court system itself. But any time that you find this many corrupt judges, prosecutors, law enforcement agencies, you expect this. But here's the deal now. I'm not through with them yet. Because now I got me a team. I got me a general. And I got me Pinckney to Pinckney. And I got me Gabriel. And I got you, Libby. What we're going to do, we're going to show them whatever they dish out that we're going to be able to take and then put it right back in their face. You see, this is the whole thing that makes this thing so wonderful. Because I tell you, this is the greatest team that's ever really been put together, and it's still growing.
Okay,
well, I have to say, you're the most extreme example of a glass half full person I've ever known.
Well, that's a pretty good statement, but look, if you got a support, you got a support of a Larry Pinckney, and you got a General Baker, and then you got Gabriel LZ, and I got Libby, and I got my Detroit connection. What more can I ask for? I can't ask for no more than this.
Okay.
And you know I'm telling the truth because y'all know me.
I know.
You know I'm telling the truth. And I said whatever they can dish out, I can take and put it right back in their face.
Yeah.
Well, I think we all understand why they're attempting to keep you in your house. They don't want you. They don't want you as a court observer, which you know you were doing every day. They don't want you to see what's going on there. I heard someone recently who worked in that courthouse in some capacity. I don't know exactly what the job was. This person was telling a group never to go into the Berrien County Courthouse ever for any reason if you can absolutely help it.
Mm-hmm.
And Reverend Pinckney went every single day for I don't know how many years as a court observer. And we know they don't want him there doing that.
But see, one thing I learned, if they don't want me there, I'm going to be there.
Well, this question of the corporate control of our lives is so important.
Right.
I mean, and this battle against Whirlpool, they're not going to give it up.
No.
And it's a war on about whether these corporations are going to control society or whether we're going to control society.
That's right.
Now, you know, Whirlpool is that example here. Down here in the auto industry, you know, General Motors is now owned by the U.S. government, the Canadian government, and the union.
Mm.
It ain't no corporate control of General Motors any longer.
Mm.
The Chrysler Corporation is run by the union, the U.S. government, and Fiat.
Can I ask a question? Are those countries, the countries that you named, are they controlled by, are those governments controlled by corporations?
Well, the U.S. government is damn sure not controlled by us yet.
No.
Even though they rule in our name.
Absolutely. And they're the biggest corporation of all.
The battle got to be for us to demand that this government be ours and not be in the hands of the corporation.
Absolutely.
We're a little better off in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
The Canadian government is a little more separate from the corporate control than the U.S. government is. So that's the kind of situation we're confronted with. But the battle goes on about trying to beat back this corporate control of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
If I may interject very quickly, the bottom line is this.
Yeah.
The only court that has integrity, the only court that has legitimacy is the people's court.
Right.
The people's court.
That's right.
We, the people, decide.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Nothing else.
That's right.
You know,
yes.
And so when it comes down to it, Libby, how do they get away with it? They get away with it for as long as we let them.
That's right. We,
that's
the
right.
people, let
that's
them.
Right.
Mm.
That's right.
It.
Mm.
That's it. And,
that's
and,
right.
and that's the problem
well
that we're facing today. See,
well
government is ran
well
by the people. We
well
the people.
Put.
But what
yeah.
we have done, we allowed them to take all these rights from us.
That's right.
Exactly.
And not stand up and fight for them.
That's well put.
Yeah.
Well put.
Couldn't be better. But, hey, I tell you, we got 2 minutes, and what I want to do, I'm going to let General, I want you to take a minute and just whatever your heart desires to say. And, Larry, I want you to take the other minute and say whatever your heart desires, and that will be the final word that you hear.
Okay, I just want to say it's been a pleasure to be on your show, Reverend Pinckney. Your fighting spirit is one that we can all gain strength from. So I just want to indicate for you to keep on fighting. I know you will.
Yes.
You fought under some of the most appalling circumstances, and keep on battling without giving up. So keep up the fight, you know, because we're going to win.
Hey, absolutely. And I know it right in my heart. Larry, you got
yeah.
about a minute. And Libby, we have any time left. You can shoot a few words in there. Let's have it.
All I have to say is this. No one of us is as strong as all of us.
That's
the bottom
right.
line is that we must collectively fight this struggle. We will win. As we say in Swahili, La Sima Tushinde Ibila Shaka, which simply means we, the people, shall succeed without a doubt. But in order to succeed, we must fight. You remember the words of the civil rights saga, that if it's one thing we did right, it was the day we started to fight.
That's
Amen.
Right. That's
Amen.
It. That's it. Beautiful. Libby?
Amen. Nice, Larry.
Libby, go ahead.
Could I sing a little?
Well, sing in your closing seconds. You got 15 seconds.
I have two sentences that were just spoken by Larry to put to melody.
Okay. Go ahead.
All right? Okay. If there's one thing we did right, was a day we stood to fight. Oh, there's more. Keep your eyes on the prize.
All right.
Hold on.
Fantastic.
Yes.
It don't get no better. And I'm going to close by saying this. I am no longer just Reverend Edward Pinckney. I am now the Commander-in-Chief. Anything that goes on in the city or in Barron County Prairie, it has to come through the Commander-in-Chief.
Fantastic.
And this is my message to Whirlpool. Yeah. That's who I want. My message goes straight to Whirlpool.
Yeah.
And that I'm getting ready to take the gloves off.
Yeah, okay.
And that is final. And those are my final words. And I want to thank you, General Baker, for a wonderful, wonderful show. And Larry, you know I love you with all my heart.
I love you.
And I tell you, you know, that this has been a tremendous show, and there's nothing else that I can say that could make this show any better. And it could only be because of you made it.
Fantastic.
But in the meantime, we're going to have to say goodbye before they cut us off and we be embarrassed. But everything else is going good.
Okay. All right.
Talk to you later.
Thank
good
you.
Night and thanks a lot.
Bye.
God bless y'all.
All right.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.